We're joined tonight by one of the gentlemen of cave diving in Australia, Ken Smith. Welcome tonight, Ken. How are you?
Thank you, Greg. I'm very good.
That's good. Just wanted to have a bit of a chat about your diving career and specifically your cave diving career. Can you give us a bit of an insight into how you started cave diving and, in fact, how you started diving altogether?
Well, I'd loved dry caving for years, and in 1982 I did a sinkhole course, or a Category 2 cave diving course, as it was called then. And I did some diving, but not for several years. But in 1987 I had the chance to go to the Nullarbor to dive, and the caves there were so wonderful that I realised I had to get into cave diving seriously, and so I did what was called the Category 3 course in 87, and then Category 4 a little bit later on, and I haven't stopped since, and I still love it.
So you're pretty active. You've dived extensively around the world. I know that you and I have been overseas a few times. What sort of locations have you been able to get to in your cave diving career?
Yes, I've been quite lucky, actually, with my international cave diving. I've dived several times in Florida, which has quite wonderful caves. These are springs with current flowing in them, which makes them quite interesting. And, of course, the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, which is a wonderful place with very extensive cave passages, warm water. And the beauty about the caves there is that they have wonderful decorations in them. The caves, when they were dry, had stalactites and stalagmites forming. And when the caves were submerged, these have been retained in the cave. And so as a diver, you can swim amongst the stalactites and stalagmites, and it's a most wonderful experience.
So Mexico is your favourite, you think?
Yes, I've not sure about Mexico. I should say I've dived in Germany as well, actually, in a spring called the Arquella, which is, again, an interesting place. And it's a place where the river Danube flows underground and re-emerges at a place called the Arquella, which is the source of the River Arc. And it's a cold dive, and the visibility is not very good. And what makes it most remarkable is that there's a very strong current in this cave. Certainly when you drive up to a cave site and you go past a hydroelectric power station, that gives you some indication that there's likely to be some current flowing in that cave. So that was an interesting and unusual cave dive. But to answer your question, I think my favourite cave probably is one I've dived in just recently, because I was lucky enough to go to the Bahamas to dive on the island of Abaco. And there we dived in a cave called Dan's Cave, and we went to a place called Fangorn Forest, which is probably the most stunningly beautiful thing I've ever seen anywhere, really. What I love about cave diving is the natural beauty that you see in the caves.
So what made that particular dive memorable for you?
What was spectacular was the perfect clarity of the water, but and also the intensity and the beauty and the diversity of the underwater formations. Again, this cave was like the caves in the Yucatan, which was dry at one stage, and very beautiful formations developed in the cave when it was dry, and these are now underwater, of course. But they're all beautifully preserved. The formations are beautiful beyond belief. Wonderful stalactites and stalagmites, beautiful helictites, very, very beautiful colours as well. These formations are not just white. They have a whole range of colours, from blood red to pure white. And it was quite a stunning experience to see this beautiful chamber. In fact, as I was swimming around, I was almost breathless with the beauty of the place. And being breathless as a diver is not such a good thing to have happen. And I was continually looking at my contents gauges, saying, gee, I shall be running out of air soon if I keep this up. But luckily the air was holding out, and I survived the dive. But it was just a wonderful experience.
Sounds a bit like a room in Mexico that I recall. The Room of Tears, was it?
The Room of Tears, yes, that's right. Again, a beautiful place.
Now, you're affectionately known as Mr. Pinger. Tell us a little bit about what the pingers are and how they came about, and what they do and how they actually work.
Well, this was a bit of a turning point in my cave diving career, because we were involved with mapping Tank Cave at Mount Gambier. And this cave is very complicated, with winding passages going for up to a kilometre away from the entrance. And when you survey a cave normally, you lay a line and you take compass bearings on each section of the line and write them all down on your slate. And hopefully on the surface you can interpret all this data to work out where the cave is going. The big problem is that there are cumulative errors. So when you've gone a kilometre into the cave through windy passages, the place where you think you are could be a long way away from the true position. So I developed a device called a pinger, which is a low-frequency radio transmitter. And the divers can place this in the cave, and then this pinger can be located by a person walking around on the surface. So you can say, exactly below my feet now is this part of the cave. So it allows you to essentially close the surveys and more accurately survey caves.
And what about the depth? How far underground are these things? work?
They can be quite deep, actually. I've used them on the Nullarbor Plain, where the divers are over 100 metres below the surface, and I can actually track the divers as they swim along, carrying their pinger, which is quite interesting. So they're useful for surveying depths of up to 100 metres, and they're audible up to about 150 metres, which is quite useful.
So the pingers, I guess, have enabled you to travel to a few interesting places and do a few dives that maybe you wouldn't have been able to do normally. Give us some ideas of where some of those places might have been.
Well, I think the pingers have changed my life because they're useful things to have, particularly if you're mapping new caves. And so people who've discovered a new cave, they're keen to map it. And they think, gee, who can we ask along to help with the radio location? And they think of me. So I get invited on all these trips, and it's not because of my personality, it's because of my ability to do radio location. And it's been wonderful over the last 8 or 9 years. I've been to new caves on the Nullarbor Plain, which has been interesting, and new caves in the Northern Territory, and the Northwestern Australia. So it's been actually quite interesting over the years.
Whereabouts do you think has been the spot that you've put the pinger that's been the most remote, and how did it actually get there?
Probably, well, I've used them in Cocklebiddy. Probably the most difficult placing of the pingers would be in Cocklebiddy Cave in the Third Sump. And I have to say I didn't place the pingers there myself. They were placed by other divers using rebreathers, but I was lucky enough to do a dive in the Third Sump in Cocklebiddy to retrieve the pingers after they'd been located. And that was a big dive. I mean, I started the dive at 10 o'clock in the morning at the main lake in Cocklebiddy, and I didn't climb out of the main lake until 1 o'clock the following morning, so it was a big day's diving. Not entirely underwater, of course. There's a lot of walking over airspaces and carrying gear, and a lot of work above water rather than the diving, of course.
But so when you tracked that pinger, or when it was tracked later on the surface, how far was it from the entrance?
The furthest pinger was approximately, I think, 6 kilometres from the entrance of the cave, so it's quite a long way. And you can imagine that to survey 6 kilometres underground and underwater could result in some quite significant cumulative errors, but in actual fact, the pinger did correct some errors, but we did find that the people who did the underwater survey had done a very good job, so the errors weren't very great, which was quite encouraging.
And what about pinger technology? Can you see these devices being used more extensively in the future of cave diving?
There's a lot of interest in using them. In Florida in particular, they're exploring caves now which are over 100 metres deep. And the problem there is not so much the range of the pingers, but the interference caused by power lines. In Florida, most caves are near built-up areas, and so there remains power lines that interfere with the pinger signal. So my challenge now is to make pingers that will work well in an area where there's mains interference. And if I can do that, I think that they will have a use in Florida. And there's also some interest in the Bahamas. I did take two pingers to the Bahamas on my recent trip. And Brian Kaycuck, who is extensively exploring caves there right now, was quite interested in using them. So I've promised him a set of pingers on loan, which I need to send off to him very shortly. So I think they'll find some use there.
So when's the next spot? Where's the next place you're going to take pingers yourself for a dive? Have you got any things planned?
There's actually no plans just at the moment, actually. I think I'm going through a phase of technical development where I need to actually improve the technology. And once I get better technology, perhaps I'll get invited on a few more trips.
Some of this technology might come back to the fact that you lost a little bit of your equipment fairly recently. Can you give us a bit of an idea of what happened then?
Yes, that was a sad day, actually. After this big dive in Cocklebiddy, when I retrieved two of my three pingers from the Third Sump, I thought I'd done pretty well. I was actually cursing that I hadn't got the third pinger. But as it turned out, I wish I'd left them all there, because on the way home we had a car fire, and the two pingers that I'd gone to such trouble to take out of the cave actually got burnt in the fire. So, and the one that I'd left in the cave, and I thought I'd lost, was actually retrieved a month later by another team of divers. So it would have been much better to leave all of the pingers in the cave.
So you lost quite a bit of gear and that fire?
I lost virtually all my dive gear. And
and some of mine, I believe.
And some of yours, Greg. Yeah, and various friends had lent me some gear, and that was lost, unfortunately. But I have to say that a lot of my dive gear deserved to be burnt. And as a result of that fire, I'm a smarter and more modern-looking diver than I was a year or two ago.
I see that there's a scooter relic that resides in Adrian's shed. Have you got some plans to resurrect that at some point?
I think the scooter is beyond resurrection. That was a wonderful scooter that I had for many years, and it went so well, and it faultlessly dragged me through caves on so many occasions, faster than most other scooters, and it was very very sad day to see it destroyed in that fire. But I think we'll I think we'll preserve the wreckage as a memento of what a great scooter it was and not to try and restore it.
Probably sounds like a good idea. Mm. Now, we know that you enjoy taking photos and being involved with video. We've just been looking at some of your photos tonight. Tell us about the time when you went up in an aeroplane around Mount Gambier to take some photographs and some video of the caves and sinkholes. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do actually. I have to say that I feel very comfortable underwater because I know I can swim, but I certainly can't fly, so going up an aeroplane always makes me a little bit nervous. And this was an occasion when we were doing some filming of the caves from an aeroplane, and I wasn't the only cameraman on the plane. There was another cameraman who was...
Yeah, Tony Carlisle, I think, wasn't
he? He was there too, actually.
Yeah, and
yes.
I think Richard McDonald was the pilot. He was also a cave diver, yeah. Mm.
And to photograph these caves properly, it was necessary to do some very, very tight turns. And we did quite a bit of this, and then after a while, Tony and I seemed to lose interest in filming. We hadn't run out of film, but we didn't really want to film anything else. And we were hoping the plane would land pretty quickly, but alas, it didn't land in time.
I still have a vision of you walking across the tarmac with a little paper bag in your hand.
It was a sad day for a cave diver.
Well, thanks very much, Ken, for having a bit of a chat.
Thank you very much.
This recording remains the property of Cave Diving Down Under. No unauthorised reproduction, distribution, or storage is permitted.